Welcome to the Mending Trauma Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy Hoyt, and along with my sister, Lena Hoyt, a licensed marriage and family therapist, we want to help you recover from trauma, whether it's childhood trauma, complex trauma, PTSD, or any other trauma sustained from abuse or narcissistic relationships. We want to help you develop skills and ways that can help you to recover from the symptoms and the effects of trauma. We are so glad you're here. Let's dive in. Hi, Amy here. Are you feeling stuck or overwhelmed by things that pop up in your daily life? And perhaps these are because of past traumas or toxic stress? Have you tried traditional therapy and found that it wasn't enough? I know that was the case for me. That's why we developed the Whole Health Lab. Mending Trauma has put together a program that combines the latest research with proven methods to help you recover from trauma and move forward from these daily stressors and triggers. We use somatic therapy, EMDR, cognitive behavioral therapy, and internal family systems therapy. We use nervous system regulation and many other tools so that we can combine the best methods that are identified in the research to help you recover without being completely overwhelmed. So you can work on trauma on your own pace, your own time, and still with the mentorship and support of a highly trained, certified staff. That's us. No more waiting for appointments or sitting in traffic, driving to see a therapist. With our online program, the Whole Health Lab, you can access it from anywhere, anytime, even on an app. Visit mendingtrauma.com/Whole Health Lab and learn more. Get your questions answered. We've got a frequently asked questions section and sign up so that you can have this life-changing program in your world today. Don't let your past hold you back any longer. Take control of your future, and we can't wait to see you in the Whole Health Lab. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. We are here today to talk about a subject that is, I think is very interesting. It's the link between trauma and self-harm and how to help our loved ones so that, you know, if you have someone in your life that's practicing self-harm, what to do and how to guide them.
Well, and also, Amy, how we might engage in self-harm as adults as well.
A great point. So typically when we think of self-harm, we think of cutting or other types of bodily physical harm that is self-induced, and it's called NSSI. And what does that stand for, Lane?
Non-suicidal self-injury. So in the research, that's the term that's used instead of self-harm. So NSSI, non-suicidal self-injury.
What does that look like? Who struggles with this? And let's talk about what we can look for as caretakers or friends. What are we looking for in terms of NSSIs?
I think that when you have somebody that you love or are close to that engages in cutting or burning or scratching, that is really alarming to people, and they tend to freak out. And the challenge with that is that when somebody is self-injurious, they are they're trying to manage an overwhelming sense of emotion, usually negative emotion, and they are not necessarily headed towards suicide. And I think that's a really important distinction. That people understand that this self-harm or this NSSI behavior is about releasing a sense of pain, emotional pain.
So self-harm is physically hurting ourselves in order to release emotional pain.
Yes, that's what I have seen in my practice. And it makes a lot of sense on some level. But what tends to happen is that when you have loved ones who self-harm, the fear is so high for it to go further that we respond in ways that actually make the self-harm more likely than less likely.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about the onset of this behavior. When does it tend to come on age-wise, and how, as a parent or a sibling or a teacher, how would you recognize it?
Okay. It tends to be pre-teen, maybe 11. I think kids are getting younger that do it now, and that's really tragic and makes my heart hurt. But 10 or 11, 11 or 12, the way it develops is kind of this internal pressure that the person experiences. It also involves a really harsh inner critic. We've talked about that before in our podcasts in the past. And this inability to have any sort of compassion for oneself when one is less than perfect or when one is not performing the way they think they should.
We also know that it tends to really start to reduce in the later teenage years. And we don't see a lot of clinical data about adults engaging in the, you know, the stereotypical self-harm, such as cutting or scratching or burning. One of the things we know from the research is that self-harm is an autonomic dysregulation. And we talk a lot about the nervous system in our program and on the podcast. And just as a reminder, the autonomic nervous system is that below conscious awareness of all of the different functions like breathing and heart rate, as well as our emotional regulation that is often under our own radar. So this to me makes so much sense because when we are in emotional pain and we feel that pressure and we need to release, because it is an autonomic dysregulation, often we don't recognize that we are having these pent-up emotions because we are not aware enough of our nervous system. So the first step is helping our teenagers, our preteens, learn about their nervous system.
Yes. And even stepping one step back from that is helping adults and parents understand how to regulate their nervous system, because we are the models for the children in our lives. And if we don't know how to regulate our own self, when we don't have skills to manage emotional regulation, when we don't have awareness of our own nervous system responses, then we can't really help as well as we'd like to somebody else who's really suffering and in a lot of pain.
That's right. And we know through the principle of co-regulation, as we've talked about before, that in order for our children to regulate, they have to have someone to anchor to who's already regulated. And so that's exactly what Lena's describing is our first step. So step zero, if you will, is getting ourselves regulated, which can be really difficult when we see our children or nieces and nephews or students we teach engaging in self-harm.
It's just such a scary concept for people, and understandably so. But if we react with a lot of intensity, it actually, like I said before, it actually makes the non-suicidal self-injury kind of harm worse.
So some of the things that we notice with adults who are having difficulty regulating around this issue is catastrophizing. And let's talk a little bit about what can we do to stop catastrophizing in this exact scenario?
It's important to understand some of the motivations for this type of self-harm, and to understand that at its root, it's relief seeking from emotions. And if you understand that, then you can go in with more emotional intelligence and try to address it with more emotional intelligence and figure out like what is going on to the child or the teen that is so much pressure, either internal or external, that they need to seek relief in self-harm behaviors.
Yes. And I would also add that linking this to trauma, it's probably really obvious to, you know, our listeners, but trauma, whether it's multi-generational or, you know, single event or new in the family system, trauma is going to cause a lot of emotional dysregulation. It's going to cause a lot of autonomic under the radar dysregulation. And so the link here is that you're already set up for emotional dysregulation as a caregiver or parent or as a child, either way, because the trauma, because of co-regulation, if it's the parent that's experienced trauma and haven't been able to deal with it, the children around them are going to sense that because of that neuroception and this, you know, underlying communication between our nervous systems. So we just want to make crystal clear that one, trauma sets us up for this. There's other reasons, but trauma absolutely sets us up for this and our children up for this. And two, there is so much hope because when we deal with our past trauma and when we deal with our own nervous system, we're set up to help our children deal with their nervous system regulation.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. And talking about the catastrophizing, there's going to be quite a bit of catastrophizing happening on a subconscious level for those who engage in an SSI behavior, but then also the loved ones who find out about it and are very, very distressed and extremely anxious or in terror for their loved one.
So we have two approaches for catastrophizing. And I think one of them is cognitive behavioral. And that is, you call this the so what game.
The so what game is you write down your sentence, your catastrophic sentence. So for example, it could be, the person I'm crushing on ignored me.
Would we be able to do this for the parent who's catastrophizing?
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's go from that perspective. Okay.
So if you are a parent or an adult, concerned adult, and you find out somebody that you care about is harming themselves, then most of the time your brain is going to turn to like the worst case scenario, which would be potential suicide. And so if you write down the sentence, my child is cutting themselves, and then you do this cognitive exercise where you say, all right, well, so what does that mean to my brain? What's the worst part about that? Then you write down the next sentence. That means that they might harm themselves enough that they die. Okay. So what's the worst thing about that for your brain? What meaning is your brain giving that? That means that I lose my child. That means I haven't been a good parent. That means that I failed, whatever it is for you. And you go through this challenging, this so what, what's the meaning, until you get to the bottom. And it's usually going to be something about our worthiness, our capacity or competence, our lovability, or being enough. And so that can be a helpful exercise. But what I've been doing lately with people that I think is more powerful and more quick is that I've been having them take 3x5 cards, and they can only write the facts on the card. They can't write anything except the facts. So they get the 3x5 card and they say to themselves, okay, what are the facts? The facts are that I found out my child has been cutting for the last 6 months. There's not a lot of additional facts that you can add to that, because a lot of what we are doing when we catastrophize is conjecture and kind of that old borrowing trouble. And so when we just include the facts, we eliminate some of that catastrophic thinking, and we're able to have more emotion regulation about what is happening.
Okay, I love that, because I like concrete tips that I can actually use in the moment. I love thought exercises, but anytime I can do pen to paper, it's going to help me concretize and kind of really interject into some of my thought errors that, you know, my inaccurate thoughts. The other way that we can help with catastrophizing is, I think, somatically. And this is where our nervous system regulation comes in and the work that we've, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're already aware of the nervous system. You're already working on heightening awareness of your nervous system. And that's the very, very, very first step. And so when we start to become aware of our nervous system and when we start to become aware of how things feel in our body and reconnect our body, it actually lowers our catastrophizing, you know, levels, because we're able to recognize what's happening in our body. And that kind of helps kind of dampen the emergency, the sense of fight flight. Not off the bat, right? Because we're going to have that immediate, but then with our new awareness, we're able to kind of bring our regulation back into play.
Yes. And the idea behind some of the things that we've talked about in the past, the internal family systems, the polyvagal theory, is that when we use a somatic exercise to calm our body down, our brain can actually tell a more neutral or accurate story. And that is really fascinating to me. So that's bottom-up approach, so from the body up to the brain. And what polyvagal theory states is that when you're in a either a sympathetic fight or flight or a dorsal vagal, which is collapse or paralyzation, your brain cannot tell a neutral or accurate story because your body is screaming, that's a big fat lie. So when we get into a situation where we're having a strong visceral response and our body is really reacting and we say to ourselves, it's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. The body doesn't believe it. And it actually doesn't work to calm us down.
Yeah. We have to go into the body, feel what's happening, and then do the tools that we have, which is, you know, journaling, breath work, tapping, checking our heart rate, looking at lowering some of our, you know, using biofeedback, if you will. Okay, so we have, this is kind of a heavy topic, and we have given you a lot of information as listeners. Anything else, Lena, that you want to leave our listeners with on this topic?
Sure. I just have a couple of brief suggestions about how to initially respond when you find out this information. And one is to not ask why. Because if you're asking your loved one why, they actually don't know most of the time. They're not going to be able to say, well, I feel a lot of pressure from school and I'm trying to get all A's in my AP classes. And that's not, you're not going to get that response. So instead of asking why, you say, I understand that a lot of times if people have overwhelming emotions, sometimes cutting or scratching themselves can help them feel less distressed. And you're not suggesting anything to them. They're already cutting or burning or scratching. And what you're doing is you're normalizing that when we are in tremendous emotional pain, we want something to relieve it. You're not normalizing that it's okay to cut. That's not what you're normalizing. You're normalizing the idea that overwhelming negative emotions are so painful that we want to do almost anything to relieve them or alleviate them. The other thing I would suggest is that people be very aware how much shame is involved in this kind of behavior, that when the person who's cutting has their own narrative of shame inside their head every time they cut. And we want to make sure that when we are dealing with it, we don't increase that level of shame and we don't use shame. So some shaming statements can be, but you're so pretty and smart. Why are you cutting? So we're not, this isn't a logical behavior. So we're not addressing it that way. And we also want to make sure that we don't say things like, you know better, you're smart enough to know better. We don't want to say, how could you do this to me? So sometimes what will happen is a kid will be found out to be self-harming and the parent makes it about them. Then we also have religious shame and guilt that can come in. Like, how could you destroy something that God gave you? That kind of thing.
So what I'm hearing is maintain neutrality, maintain calm. You're not putting your fears on them. You are actually just offering them some information, such as, you know, I understand that this is a release of emotional pain. And in that way, you're normalizing that this is a way to release pain. And then what's the next step? Are we looking at individual therapy? Are we looking at what is the next step if you have a young adult or teenager who's doing this in your life?
I think individual therapy can be really helpful. And you also may want to consider medical attention because sometimes, especially with scratching with the fingernails, you can have a lot of potential infection. So we also want to make sure that we're aware medically of any needs that come out of this kind of behavior. And we also want to make sure that we kind of check ourselves as a loving adult or caretaker, that we are not putting unreasonable pressure on our kids to perform. And that we don't have this expectation that they're supposed to always be calm and happy, that we as parents or loved ones can tolerate when they are sad or mad or discouraged or disappointed. And again, that goes back to the adults being able to have some semblance of nervous system regulation so that when your child is sad or upset, it doesn't drown you. That you can be present for the child in that emotion without being in terror.
Thank you so much, Lena. I think this is such an important topic. And I know that as a parent of teenagers and children, I have a lot of thoughts right now about preventative and how to prevent this emotional buildup for my own children and just allowing them to express their emotions without punishment. And I think that's one of the biggest gifts we can give to children in our lives. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. We look forward to being with you next week. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Mending Trauma Podcast. Lane and I are really grateful that you spend time with us each week. We know you have a choice and that time is currency. We would love if you would share this episode on social media and tag us so we can reshare. If you feel so inclined, go and give us a 5-star review wherever you listen to pods so that we can get the word out and help more people. We know that we are all working hard on our mental health and we wish you great success this week in implementing these new skills. We'll check in next week.